There was a click. George turned. All the time he'd been in the control centre with Hagbard, he had never looked back at the door through which he had come. He was surprised to see that it looked like an opening in thin air, or thin water. On either side of the doorway was blue-green water, and a dark horizon, which was actually the ocean bottom. Then, in the centre, the doorway itself, and a golden light silhouetting the figure of a beautiful woman. Mavis strode onto the balcony, pulling the door shut behind her. She was wearing forest green tights with white patent leather boots and a wide white belt. Her small but well-shaped breasts jiggled naturally under her blouse. George found himself thinking back to the scene on the beach. That was only this morning. And what time was it anyway? What time where? Back in Florida, it was probably 2 or 3 in the afternoon, which would make it 1 p.m. in Mad Dog, Texas. And probably about 6 out here in the Atlantic. Did time zones extend beneath the water? He supposed they did. On the other hand, if you were at the North Pole, you could skip around the pole and be in a different time zone every few seconds, and cross the international dateline every few minutes if you wanted to. Which would not, he reminded himself, make it possible to travel in time. But if he could go back to this morning and replay Mavis's demand for sex, this time he would respond. He now wanted her desperately. Well and good, but why did she say he was not a schmuck? Why did she imply admiration for him because he would not fuck her? If he had fucked her because she asked him and he felt he should, but without wanting to, he would have been a pure and simple schmuck. But he could have pronged her simply because she would have been nice to fuck, regardless of whether she would have admired him or despised him. But that was their game. Mavis's and Hagbard's game of saying, I do what I want to do and I don't give a damn what you think. George cared a great deal about what other people thought. So not fucking Mavis, at the time, was at least honest, even if he was beginning to see some merit in the Discordian, he supposed it was Discordian, attitude of super self-sufficiency. Mavis smiled at him.
Well, George, had your baptism of fire?
George shrugged.
Well, that was the Mad Dog jail, and I've been in a few other bad scenes.
For instance, there was a time I held a pistol to my head and pulled the trigger. She'd sucked his cock. He'd watched her in manic masturbation. But he was desperate to get inside her, all the way up the womb, riding her ovarian trolley to the wonderful land of fuck, as Henry Miller said. What the hell was so special about Mavis's cunt? Especially after that induction ceremony scene. How? Stella Maris seemed like a less neurotic woman, and was certainly a classic lay. After Stella Maris, who needed Mavis? A sudden question struck him. How did he know he'd laid Stella? It could have been Mavis inside that golden apple. It could have been some woman he'd never met. He was pretty sure it was a woman, unless it was a goat, a cow, or a sheep. Let's not put that kind of joke past Hagbard either. But even if it was a woman, why visualise Stella or Mavis or somebody like them? It was probably some diseased old Etruscan whore that Hagbard kept around for religious purposes, some sibyl, some what witch. Maybe it was Hagbard's rotten old Sicilian mother with no teeth, a black shawl and 3 kinds of VD. No, it was Hagbard's father who was Sicilian. His mother was Norwegian.
What colour were they?
He said suddenly to Hagbard.
Who? The Atlanteans. Oh.
Hagbard nodded.
They were covered with fur over most of their bodies like any normal ape. At least the high Atlanteans were. A mutation occurred around the time of the Hour of the Evil Eye and the catastrophe that destroyed High Atlantis. Later, Atlanteans, like modern humans, were hairless. Those of the oldest Atlantean ancestry tend to be rather furry.
George couldn't help looking down at Hagbard's hand as it rested on the railing. It was covered with thick black hair.
All right,
said Hagbard.
It's time to head back to our North American base. Howard, you out there?
The long, streamlined shape performed a somersault on their right.
What's happening, Hagbard?
Have some of your people keep an eye on things here. We've got work to do on land. And Howard, as long as I live, I will be in debt to your people for the four who died to save me.
Haven't you and the Leif Erikson saved us from several kinds of deaths planned for us by the shore people?
Said Howard.
We'll keep watch over Atlantis for you and the seas in general and that which Atlantis has spawned. Hail and farewell, Hagbard and other friends! The sea is wide and the sea is deep, but warm as blood through it there rolls a tide of friendship that will keep us close in ocean's blackest holes.
He was gone.
Lift off,
Hagbard called. George felt the surge of the sub's colossal engines, and they were sailing high above the hills and valleys of Atlantis. With the special lighting of Hagbard's television screen system, it seemed much like flying in a jet plane over one of the continents above the ocean's surface.
Too bad we don't have time to get deeper into Atlantis,
said Hagbard.
There are many mighty cities to see, though of course none of them can approach the cities that existed before the hour of the evil eye.
How many of these Atlantean civilizations were there?
Asked George.
Basically two. One leading up to the hour, and one afterward. Before the hour, there was a civilization of about 1 million human beings on this continent. Technically, they were further advanced than the human race is today. They had atomic power, space travel, genetic technology, and much else. This civilization was struck a death blow in the hour of the evil eye. 2/3 of them were killed, almost half the human population of the planet at that time. After the hour, something made it impossible for them to make a comeback. The cities that came through the first catastrophe relatively undamaged were destroyed in later disasters. The inhabitants of Atlantis were reduced to savagery in a generation. Part of the continent sank under the sea, which was the beginning of the process that ended when all of Atlantis was underwater as it is today.
Was this the earthquakes and tidal waves that you always read about?
George asked.
No,
said Hagbard with a curious, closed expression.
It was man-made. High Atlantis was destroyed in a kind of war, probably a civil war, since there was no other power on the planet that could have matched them.
Anyway, if there had been a victor, they'd still be around now,
said George.
They are,
said Mavis.
The victors are still around. Only they're not what you might visualize. Not a conquering nation. We are the descendants of the defeated. Now,
said Hagbard,
I'm going to show you something I promised when we first met. It has to do with the catastrophe I've been talking about. Look there.
The submarine had risen high above the continent, and it was possible to see landscapes stretching for hundreds of miles. Looking in the direction in which Hagbard pointed, George saw a vast expanse of black, glazed plain. Out of its center jutted something white and pointed, like a canine tooth.
It is said of them that they even controlled the comets in their courses,
said Hagbard. He pointed again. The submarine sailed closer to the jutting white object. It was a four-sided white pyramid.
Don't say it,
said Mavis, giving him a warning look, and George remembered the tattoo he had seen between her breasts. He looked down again. They were above the pyramid now, and George could see the side that had been hidden from him as they approached. He saw what he had half feared, half expected to see, a blood-red design in the shape of a baleful eye.
The pyramid of the eye,
Hagbard said.
It stood in the center of the capital of High Atlantis. It was built in the last days of that civilization by the founders of the world's first religion. It doesn't look very big from up here, but it's 5 times the size of the Great Pyramid of Cheops, which was modeled after it. It's made of an imperishable ceramic substance which repels even ocean sediment. as if the builders knew that to last it would have to survive tens of thousands of years of ocean burial. And maybe, depending on who they were, they did know that. Or maybe they just built well in those days. Paos, as you saw, was a pretty durable city, and that was built after High Atlantis fell by the second civilization I spoke of. That second civilization reached a level somewhat more advanced than that of the Greeks and Romans, but it was nothing like its predecessor. And some malevolent force seemed bent on destroying it too, and it was destroyed about 10,000 years ago. Of that civilization, we have the evidence of ruins. But of High Atlantis, we have only records and legends dug up from later civilizations. And, of course, poetry from the Porpoise Corpus. This is the only artifact, this pyramid. But its existence and durability prove that as long ago as 10 Egypts, a race of men existed whose technology was far advanced beyond what we know today. So advanced that it took 20,000 years for that civilization's successor culture to disappear completely. The men who destroyed High Atlantis did their best to make it disappear, but they couldn't quite manage it. The Pyramid of the Eye, for instance, is indestructible, though it's probable that they didn't want to destroy it.
Mavis nodded somberly.
That is their most sacred shrine. In other words,
said George,
you're telling me that the people who destroyed Atlantis still exist. Do they have the powers they had then? Substantially, yes,
said Hagbard.
Is this the Illuminati you told me about? Illuminati, or Ancient Illuminated Seers of Bavaria, is one of the names they have used, yes. So they didn't start in 1776. They go a long way back before that, right?
Right, said Mavis.
Then why did you lie to me about their history? And why the hell haven't they taken over the world by now, if they're all that powerful? When our ancestors were savages, they could have dominated them completely.
Hagbard replied,
I lied to you, because the human mind can only accept a little of the truth at a time. Also, initiation into Discordianism has stages. The answer to the other question is complicated, but I'll try to give it to you simply. There are 5 reasons. First, there are organizations like the Discordians, which are almost as powerful, and which know almost as much as the Illuminati, and which are able to thwart them. Second, the Illuminati are too small a group to enjoy the creative cross-fertilization necessary to progress of any kind. And they have been unable to advance much beyond the technological level they reached 30,000 years ago. Like Chinese mandarins. Third, the Illuminati are hamstrung in their actions by the superstitious beliefs that set them apart from other Atlanteans. As I told you, they're the world's first religion. Fourth, the Illuminati are too sophisticated, ruthless, and decadent to want to take over the world. It amuses them to play with the world. Fifth, the Illuminati do rule the world, and everything that happens, happens by their sufferance. Those reasons contradict each other,
said George.
That's the nature of logical thought. All propositions are true in some sense, false in some sense, and meaningless in some sense.
Hagbard didn't smile. The submarine had described a great arc as they talked, and now the Pyramid of the Eye was far behind them. The eye itself, since it faced eastward, was no longer visible. Below, George could see the ruins of several small cities at the edge of tall cliffs that fell away into darker depths. Cliffs that, doubtless, had been the seacoast of Atlantis at one time. Hagbard said,
I've got a job for you, George. You're going to like it, and you're going to want to do it. But it's going to make you shit a brick. We'll talk about it when we get to Chesapeake Base. Now, though, let's go down into the hold and have a look at our acquisitions.
He flicked a switch.
Fuck up. Get your finger out of your ass and drive this thing for a while. I'll see the statues later,
said Mavis.
I've got other things to do just now.
George followed Hagbard down carpeted staircases and halls panelled in glowing polished oak. At last they came to a large hall, which was apparently paved with marble flagstones. A group of men and women wearing horizontally striped nautical shirts, similar to Hagbard's, were clustered around four tall statues in the centre of the room. When Hagbard entered the room, they stopped talking and stepped away to give him a clear look at the sculptures. The floor was covered with puddles of water, and the statues themselves were dripping.
No wiping them dry,
Hagbard said.
Every molecule is precious, just as it is, and the less disturbed, the better.
He stepped closer to the nearest one and looked at it for a long moment.
What do you say about a thing like this? It's beyond exquisite. Can you imagine what their art was like before the disaster? And to think the unbroken circle destroyed every trace of it, except for that crude, stupid pyramid. Which is the greatest piece of ceramic technology in the history of the human race,
said one of the women. George looked around for Stella Maris, but she wasn't there.
Where's Stella?
He asked Hagbard.
Upstairs, minding the store. She'll see them later.
The sculptures were unlike the work of any culture George knew, which was to be expected after all. They were at once realistic, fanciful, and abstractly intellectual. They bore resemblance to Egyptian and Mayan, classical Greek, Chinese, and Gothic, combined with a surprisingly modern-looking note. There were some qualities in the statues that were totally unique, though qualities doubtless lost by the civilizations to which Atlantis was ancestral, but that might have been found in known world art had there been other civilizations to preserve and emphasize them. This, George realized, was the art. And looking at the statues was like hearing a sentence in the first language spoken by men. An elderly sailor, pointing at the statue farthest from where they were standing.
Look at that beatific smile. A woman thought of that statue, I bet. That's every woman's dream, to be totally self-sufficient.
Some of the time, Joshua,
said the Oriental woman who hadn't spoken before.
But not all of the time. Now, what I prefer is that.
She pointed to another statue. Hagbard laughed.
You think that's just nice, healthy orogenitalism, Sushi.
But the child in the woman's arms is the son without a father, the self-begotten, and the couple at the base represent the unbroken circle of Gruad. Usually it's a serpent with its tail in its mouth, but in some of the earlier representations, the couple in oral intercourse symbolizes sterile lust. The unloved mother has her foot on the man's head to indicate that she conquers lust. The whole sculpture is the product of the foulest cult to come out of Atlantis. They originated human sacrifice. First, they practice castration, but then they escalated to killing men instead of just cutting off their balls. Later, when women were subjugated, the sacrifice became a virgin female, supposedly to give her to the unloved ones while she was still pure. That halo around the child's head looks like the peace symbol,
said George.
Peace symbol, my ass,
said Hagbard.
That's the oldest symbol of evil there is. Of course, in the cult of the unbroken circle, it was a symbol of good, but that's the same difference.
They can't have been so vicious if they produced that statue,
said the Oriental woman stubbornly.
Could you deduce the Spanish Inquisition from the painting of the manger at Bethlehem?
Said Hagbard.
Don't be naive, Miss Mao.
He turned to George.
The value of any one of these statues is beyond calculation, but not many people know that. I'm sending you to one who does. Robert Putney Drake. One of the finest art connoisseurs in the world and the head of the American branch of the World Crime Syndicate. You're going to see him with a gift from me. These four statues. The Illuminati were planning to buy his support with gold from the Temple of Tethys. I'm going to get to him first.
If they only needed four statues, why were they trying to raise the whole temple?
George asked.
I think they wanted to remove the temple to Agarti, their stronghold under the Himalayas, for safekeeping.
I haven't been any closer to the Temple of Tethys than we were today, but I suspect it's a treasure house of evidence of High Atlantis. As such, it would be something the Illuminati would want to remove. Until now, there was no reason to, because no one had access to the sea bottom other than the Illuminati. Now I can get around down here just as well, better in fact than they can, and pretty soon others will be following. Several nations and many groups of private persons are exploring the undersea world. It's time for the Illuminati to finish taking away whatever tells of High Atlantis.
Will they destroy that city we saw? And what about the Pyramid of the Eye?
Hagbard shook his head.
They'd be willing to let later Atlantean ruins to be found. That wouldn't say anything about their existence. As for the Pyramid of the Eye, I suspect they have a real problem with that. They can't destroy it, and even if they could, they wouldn't want to. But it's a dead giveaway to the existence of a super-civilization in the past. Well,
said George, not at all wanting to meet the head of the American Crime Syndicate.
What we ought to do is go back and raise the Temple of Tethys ourselves, before the Illuminati grab it.
Good grief,
said Miss Mao.
This happens to be the most critical moment in the history of this civilization. We don't have time to fiddle fuck around with archaeology.
He's just a legionnaire,
said Hagbard.
Though after this mission, he'll know the fairest and become a deacon. He'll understand more then. George, I want you to act as a go-between for the Discordian movement and the Syndicate. You're going to bring these four statues to Robert Putney Drake and tell him there are more where they came from. Ask Drake to stop working for the Illuminati, to take the heat off our people, wherever he's after them, and to drop the assassination project the Illuminati have been working on with him. And as an earnest of good faith, he's to snuff 24 Illuminati agents for us in the next 24 hours. Their names will be contained in a sealed envelope, which you will give him.
Fives. Sex. Here is wisdom. The mumble of the breast is the mutter of man. State's Attorney Milo A. Flanagan stood on the roof of the high-rise condominium on Lakeshore Drive in which he lived, scanning blue-grey Lake Michigan with powerful binoculars. It was April the 24th, and Project Tethys should be completed. At any moment, Flanagan expected to sight what would look like another Great Lakes freighter heading for the Chicago River locks. Only this one would be carrying a dismantled Atlantean temple crated in its hold. The ship would be recognizable by a red triangle painted on the funnel. After being inspected by Flanagan, his name in the order was Brother Johann Beghard, and after his report had been sent to the Vigilance Lodge, the North American Command Center, the crated temple would be moved downriver to St. Louis, where by prior agreement with the President of the United States, it would be trucked overland to Fort Knox under the guard of the U.S. Army. The President didn't know with whom he was dealing. The CIA had informed him that the source of the artifacts was the Livonian nationalist movement now behind the Iron Curtain, and that the crates would contain Livonian art treasures. Certain high officers in the CIA did know the real nature of the organization which the US was helping, because they were members of it. Of course, the Syndicate, without even a cover story, was keeping three-quarters of its gold in with a government store at Fort Knox these days.
Where could you find a safer place?
Robert Putney Drake once asked. But the freighter was behind schedule. The wind battered at Flanagan, whipping his wavy white hair and the well-tailored jacket sleeves and trouser legs. The goddamn Chicago wind. Flanagan had been fighting it all his life. It had made him the man he was. Police Sergeant Otto Waterhouse emerged from the doorway to the roof. Waterhouse was a member of Flanagan's personal staff, which meant he was on the police department payroll. The Syndicate payroll, and another payroll that regularly deposited a fixed sum in the account of Herr Otto Wasserhaus in a Bavarian bank. Waterhouse was a 6.5-foot tall black man who had made a career for himself in the Chicago Police Department by being more willing and eager to harass, torture, maim and kill members of his race than the average Mississippi sheriff. Flanagan had early spotted Waterhouse's ice-cold, self-hating love affair with death and had attached him to his staff.
"A message from CFR Communications Center in New York,"
said Waterhouse.
"The word has come through from Ingolstadt that Project Tethys was aborted."
Flanagan lowered his binoculars and turned to look at Waterhouse. The state's attorney's florid face, with its bushy pepper-and-salt eyebrows, was shrewd and distinguished. The sort of face people vote for, especially in Chicago. It was a face that had once belonged to a kid who had run with the hamburgers in Chicago's South Side Irish ghetto and bashed out the brains of black men with cobblestones for the fun of it. It was a face that had come from that primitive beginning to knowing about 10,000-year-old sunken temples, spider ships and international conspiracies. It was stamped indelibly with the lines of Milo A. Flanagan's ancestors, the ancestors of the Gauls, Britons, Scots, Picts, Welsh and Irish. Around the time the Temple of Tethys was sinking into the sea, they had been driven forth on orders from Agati, from that thick ancient forest that is now the desert country of Outer Mongolia. But Flanagan was only a fourth-degree Illuminatus and not fully instructed in the history. Though he did not display much emotion, there were blue-white flames of murderous madness burning deep in his eyes. Waterhouse was one of the few people in Chicago who could meet Flanagan's baleful stare head-on.
"How did it happen?"
Flanagan asked.
"They were attacked by porpoises, an invisible submarine. The spider craft were all blown to bits. The Zvek came in and counterattacked, was damaged by a laser beam and forced to disengage."
"How did they find out we had spider ships at the temple site?"
"Maybe the porpoises told them."
Flanagan looked at Waterhouse coldly and thoughtfully.
"Maybe it was leaked at this end, Otto. There are jams active in this town, more here than anywhere in the country right now. Dillinger's been spotted twice in the last week. By Gruat, how I'd like to be the one to really get him, once and for all. What would Hoover's ghost say then, huh, Otto?"
Flanagan grinned, one of his rare, genuine smiles, exposing prominent canine teeth.
"We know there's a jam cult center somewhere on the north side. Someone's been stealing hosts from my brother's church for the past 10 years, even at times when I've had as many as 30 men staked out there. And my brother says there have been more cases of demonic possession in his parish in the last 5 years than in all of Chicago in all its previous history. One of our sensitives has reported emanations of the old woman in this area at least once a month during the past year. It's a long past time we found them. They could be reading our minds, Otto. That could be the leak. Why haven't we got a fix on them?"
Waterhouse, who only a few years ago had known nothing more unconventional than how to turn a homicide into killed while resisting arrest, looked back calmly at Flanagan and said,
"We need 10 sensitives of the 5th grade to perform the pentacle, and we've only got 7.
Flanagan shook his head.
"There are 17 5th graders in Europe, 8 in Africa, and 23 scattered around the rest of the world. You'd think they could spare us 3 for a week. That's all it would take."
Waterhouse said,
"Maybe you've got enemies in the higher circle. Maybe somebody wants to see us get it."
"Why the hell do you say things like that, Waterhouse?"
"Just to fuck you up, man."
8 floors below, in an apartment which was regularly used for black masses, a North Clark Street hippie named Skip Lynch opened his eyes and looked at Simon Moon and Padre Pederastia.
"Time's getting very short,"
he said.
"We gotta finish off Flanagan soon."
"It can't be too soon for me,"
said Padre Pederastia.
"If Daddy hadn't favored him so outrageously, he'd be the priest today, and I'd be state's attorney."
Simon nodded.
"But then we'd be snuffing you instead of Milo. Anyway, I believe George Dorm will be taking care of the problem for us right now.